यहां ब्लू लाइन के लिए बदलें।
इंडिया, लाइक न्यू दिल्ली'स ब्रांड न्यू सबवे सिस्टम, इज अ कंट्री ऑन द मूव।
इन द कमिंग डेकेड्स, इंडिया विल बी इन अ लीडरशिप पोजीशन इन द वर्ल्ड।
Nuclear arms, a rising economy, and new ties to the U.S. have given India a prominent place on the world stage.
We are an important global player, and we feel the need for the rest of the world to recognize that.
But the country faces many challenges.
India now needs to get its act together.
Will poverty, terrorism, and the global financial crisis derail India's superpower ambition? And succeed or fail, what does this mean for the rest of us? I'm David Brown, and this is the story of India Rising from the Stanley Foundation, KQED Public Radio, and KUT Austin.
India is on the move, but doesn't know which direction it needs to go to.
Our journey gets underway after this. You slowly open your eyes in the springs. And even though everyone says expect the unexpected, nothing really prepares you for this. Dogs dart through lawn sprinklers in front of row after row of new stucco homes. Palm trees dot the meticulously manicured yards. And children pack into the back of their parents' Mercedes for the drive to school.
Bye, baby. Hey.
Welcome to India. This may very well be the future of India, and yet, just beyond these gates, literally a few dozen feet away, overpacked rickshaws and spindly mopeds battle with tinny taxis through congested streets, past mothers cradling infants begging for food or money. Power lines sag as if from the weight of age and overconsumption. And it is hard to imagine this as a country prepared to take its place with the established powers of the world. Welcome to India. I'm David Brown. Over the next hour, we're going to be exploring a place of such enormous human capital and economic potential, a nuclear-armed, English-speaking democracy, over a billion people strong, that it's little wonder India's been called the world's next superpower. And yet, it is a place so burdened by its infrastructure, by illiteracy, and by poverty, that its claim for a place on the world stage may be seriously threatened. This is India Rising, a production of the Stanley Foundation, KQED Public Radio, and KUT Austin. If there were any doubts about whether India matters to the rest of the world, they were silenced by an event known here as 2611. On the 26th of November, 2008, the world's attention turned to a frightening chain of events unfolding in Mumbai, the great cultural and financial center located on the West Coast. If the terrorist attacks on Mumbai were, in fact, India's 9/11, well, correspondent Simon Marks is at the place one might call its ground zero.
David, I'm standing in the shadow of the Gateway of India, right opposite the Taj Hotel. That's the domed building you saw burning on television last November after terrorists attacked it and a handful of other prominent targets here. Once a war zone, as the terrorists inside the hotel fought pitched battles with Indian commandos below, this cobbled pedestrian precinct is now open to tourists again. The Taj is open for business, and Mumbai is in recovery. Business is booming at the Cafe Leopold in Mumbai. For 138 years, waiters here have delivered frosted pitchers of beer and hot plates of spicy Indian nibbles to the tourists and locals who frequent this popular wood-paneled watering hole. It's just half a mile from the Gateway of India, the colonial-era monument that looks out on the Arabian Sea. Visitors from cruise liners, along with employees of local businesses, all gravitate to the cafe to quench their thirsts and satiate their appetites in South Mumbai's hot and humid climate.
South Mumbai, like, we never expected this to happen in South Mumbai.
Eric Anthony has managed this family-owned cafe for 10 years, and what he never expected could happen did happen last November 26th. At 9:30 p.m., he and his customers found themselves under attack by two heavily armed men bearing submachine guns. The terrorist attack on Mumbai that would take more than 170 lives and more than 3 days to subdue, had begun.
This is the bullet. This went from here. Came out from here.
Today, the cafe has hung pictures to cover up some of the fist-sized bullet holes that the gunman left in their wake. One of the pictures, with a hint of black humour, is a sign that reads, "All rights of admission reserved." Outside, three armed guards now protect the cafe, a reflection of the added security costs being borne by thousands of businesses in India's financial capital after the terror attacks revealed gaping holes in the country's national security infrastructure.
I think after the attack, the people are more responsible now, not the government. The government cannot do anything because the police also has done nothing.
Immediately after last November's attacks, there was intense anger on the streets of Mumbai over the remarkable ease with which 10 terrorists had brought mayhem to the city. Thousands of protesters jammed the lanes around the cafe and the terrorists' other targets, the Taj and Oberoi hotels, the city's central railroad station and a Jewish community centre. Down with politicians, down with Pakistan, the demonstrators chanted, their anger directed in equal measure at two governments they held responsible for the attacks, the country's immediate neighbour, where the terrorists were trained, and their own, for failing to protect India's people.
I think the expectation, and that was pretty much the youth of India actually crying out, was really for some sense of action. Unlike most terrorist attacks, one needs to keep in mind that this particular one was pretty much a sort of a 50 to 60 hour war.
The stock was down nearly 4% today, but it bounced back intraday.
But Ronnie Skruvala, one of Mumbai's most successful entrepreneurs, says the public's cry for action has been mostly met by rhetoric. He's the founder and CEO of UTV, an entertainment conglomerate operating 6 commercial television networks, including an all-business channel. Its newsroom hums with the quiet efficiency that can be found at any of its American counterparts. But the network's owner worries that little has been done in the months since the attacks to make Mumbai any less vulnerable to a band of dedicated terrorists.
I don't think they'd find it harder or difficult at this point to do anything differently. And that's primarily because there's no central chain of command. Till we actually get that into place, it's multiple authorities looking at their own jurisdiction or their responsibility, and therefore no, it can recur again at any time.
I think the city has gone on to business as usual. The sad part is that what really should happen on ground in terms of security hasn't quite got off the ground as it should.
Rear Admiral Mahendra Pratap Taneja retired from the Indian Navy 3 years ago, capping a 36-year career. The government, he says, is creating a national investigation agency empowered to battle terrorism and has plans to base elite commandos in 4 of the country's major cities. But he says agencies like the Coast Guard still lack the basic assets, ships, aircraft and radar systems that they need to police the waters surrounding India effectively. Change, he suggests, is taking too much time.
I'm not sure we've reacted quite as fast as we should have. We as a people, I think, don't do things so quickly. We like to think, mull over, and then actually take action.
There is no country in the world which can provide ironclad security.
That's Anant Sharma, India's Minister of State for External Affairs, one of the country's top government officials. Speaking from his office in the imposing warren of colonial-era government buildings in New Delhi, he says India is now facing the same terrorist scourge that bedevils the developed world.
There were bombings in Madrid, bombings in London. New York was attacked. Yes, we had failures. We must admit as a government. The Prime Minister of the country had the humility to apologize. But it was a very difficult situation. I'm sure that, God forbid, if such a situation arises, many of the lapses which were there in Mumbai will not be there. But there is no country which is safe.
Back in Mumbai, it's business almost as usual for Bollywood, the financially flourishing movie industry born in the city that has helped propel India on its journey to developed world status. On stage in a disused theatre not far from the scene of the terrorist attacks, actor Shahid Kapoor, a Bollywood heartthrob, is being made up ahead of a scene in his next big love story. The stage is bathed with light. The actor stands alone, surrounded by a gaudy red and golden set.
It's a nice, happy story that if you dream, you can make it.
But, says the film's director Ken Ghosh, that's because he started work on this project 18 months ago. Today, he says, with the terror attacks fresh in the public's mind, audiences are demanding more.
There's a lot more things in the pipeline where it's not only about songs and dances that we're normally known for, but our films need to say something now. Obviously, cinema is a mirror of society, so we're only going to make films that the audiences want to see.
It's also an indication that the terror attacks raised fundamental questions about whether India's governmental and strategic infrastructure will hold it back from achieving its potential. Questions that many in Mumbai say have not been properly answered yet.
Ready? Stand by.
For India Rising, Simon Marks, Mumbai.
Roll sound.
The arduous task of reconstructing, of rebuilding, even of reimagining the structures and the institutions which have let the Indian people down is now beginning.
That's Shashi Tharoor, Indian writer, politician, and diplomat, the former Undersecretary General of the United Nations. Prior to what Indians call 2611, there had been other terrorist attacks on big cities in India, but this, he says, this was the final straw.
There's now a very, very large consensus across the political class, yes, but also across the middle class, across ordinary people, voters, north, south, east and west, that there has to be real change in this country, as well as real accountability both here and abroad.
Tharoor argues that the terrorist attacks threw a Klieg light on India's weaknesses, just as the world was starting to think of the country as a rapidly growing economic power, a regional up-and-comer. Suddenly, there was evidence that the young generation of Indians driving economic growth doesn't necessarily represent the rest of the nation.
Well, the curious paradox about India is that it is indeed a land of paradoxes, and that both were happening simultaneously. That we were having people struggling along in bullock carts while shooting rockets off to the moon. I mean, this is something that has always been true about India. But the broad approach has been fairly relaxed and lackadaisical, and that's why the areas of Indian excellence, IT, medical research, and of course many aspects of our military, those areas of excellence stood out precisely because they used a level of energy, of creativity, of dynamism, of determination, discipline, hard work that is not typical of the rest of Indian society. It's not that Indians are not capable of it, it's that the system didn't require it of them. The system therefore has to change.
Shashi Tharoor, Indian diplomat, politician, and the author of The Elephant, the Tiger, and the Cell Phone, India, the Emerging 21st Century Power. But it's one thing to be reflecting on all this from a modern hotel suite in Mumbai, and nearly impossible to do from this vantage point. A typical farming village in the center of India. From here, the country's 21st century potential could not feel more distant. The only light, apart from a naked bulb dangling from a lonely power line, is the glow from the dial of a rickety radio hung on a nearby tree trunk. More than 500 million Indians live in rural villages, many without even these modern conveniences. And yet only a half day's drive from here are the supermarkets, schools, shopping malls, and high-tech offices that suggest a new land of opportunity. Coming up next, a day in the life of two Indias, as our special report, India Rising, continues.
Chandana Mabu Tirupati Gadu Chin.
From the Stanley Foundation, KQED Public Radio, and KUT Austin, you're listening to India Rising. I'm David Brown. On the outskirts of the central Indian city of Hyderabad, in a district called High Tech City, it is 6:30 in the morning. The day begins with juice and breakfast, getting the kids ready for school.
Bye, Mukun. I'm going to the office, okay? Don't run.
Okay. In some ways, Sarisha Gumaregula's daily routine is not much different from that of her old life as an attorney in Manhattan. Only here, she has three domestic helpers, a beautiful modern two-story home in a handsome gated subdivision. But alas, no Starbucks, at least not yet.
I think the 6 o'clock coffee shop may not work yet because Indians are not early risers. So I think once now, at least in High Tech City, most offices start like at 9 o'clock. So there definitely is the need, you know.
Sarisha is part of a new generation of Indians who left their country for the U.S. and Europe in the early 90s, only to discover that India was fast becoming the new land of opportunity. 5 years ago, Sarisha returned to India to launch a new business here, from scratch. At sunup, she gets in her chauffeured luxury sedan and begins a brisk 15-minute ride to the office. At this pace, who needs coffee?
I love getting up in the morning and going to work. I don't particularly like being rudely woken up at 6:30 by both my kids jumping on me, but you know, once I get past that, there is always something new that you're doing. The fact that, you know, you have a young workforce, they have not been impacted by people or by experiences which kind of teach them that you can't do certain things. So for them, everything is possible.
According to some estimates, more than 60% of India's workforce is under age 35. Sarisha, a COO of her own company, has yet to turn 40.
Thanks, Vishnu.
When we pull up to our office in a handsome high-rise, we notice other tenants of the building, Google, Symantec, familiar names all. Past the doors of Quizlic, Sarisha's startup, a battery of some 200 young attorneys work in cubicles, analyzing legal documents emailed to them overnight from the States. They comb through depositions, draft contracts, that sort of thing, then email their work back to law firms in New York, Washington, Chicago, and L.A.
Welcome to everyone to this week's training, and you know, as part of our series on how can we approach an issue differently.
Forget call centers. This is outsourcing on an entirely new level. Professional work, intellectual heavy lifting. And it's not only forging a new business model here, it's changing how business is being done back in the U.S. And just how is business? Well, it's so good they have to turn away clients. But that's not the best part, Sarisha says.
Having roots in India, always wanted to come back to see as to how can I give back to the country. So to a certain extent, I think to the vibrancy and the energy of coming back and playing a big part in molding, particularly as a woman, to women employees. I'm cognizant of the fact that even today, you are not allowed to get results of your natal testing because most of the time, if it is found to be a girl, they abort the kid, you know. So to a certain extent, like coming back and being able to empower women, at least in our organization.
The government here in High Tech City is trying to make the climate more business friendly, lifting ancient paternalistic laws that forced women to stop work by 6 p.m., laws that would make this business impossible to run if enforced. But on another level, just look out the window at the streetscape below, and there are reminders all around of how Sarisha cannot count on the government to look after her interests.
I can't guarantee that the trains will come on time, so what do? I take charge of transportation. There are several things like that. All of the power, you know, there are power cuts, so I have three backups. If one fails, the other one comes in. If two fail, the other one comes in. So your entire business model is built on trying to address some of the uncertainties that you have in a developing economy.
But perhaps the greatest uncertainty in this developing economy is a global economic downturn and whether India can weather the winds from the West. This year alone, the world's economy is projected to shrink by at least 2%. Yet by those same projections, India's economy will remain one of the most buoyant in the world with a growth rate of 7%.
Having a positive 7% growth is certainly an advantage. But is that enough? No,
Economist and author Amit Mitra is Secretary General of the Indian Federation of Chambers of Commerce.
Why do we need this kind of growth? Because every year, 9 million young people join the labor force in India because of the young population, and they need jobs. For that, we need 9 to 10% growth. So 7%, which is what we are growing at today, for us, is not enough.
To put it another way, for every million new people entering the workforce, India's economy has to grow by about 1%. That means that this year, even if you assume the most optimistic growth projections, that'll leave 2 million new workers unable to find jobs. And next year, they'll still be looking for jobs as even more people join the workforce. You don't have to be a math wizard to figure this one out. At this rate, India's boom is simply unsustainable. But if you get in a car and you drive just a little ways outside the city, 20, 30 miles in just about any direction, you might fairly ask what boom we're talking about. A half day's drive from High Tech City, it could scarcely be any more low tech than this place. A village of about 500 homes in the middle of, well, for all intents and purposes, the middle of nowhere. The town center consists of a pile of rocks surrounded by goats that provide milk. There's a simple landing, a place to sit and chat, illuminated by a single light bulb and a radio hanging from a tree trunk that's constantly playing a Hindi station. Few here speak much English at all. The only vehicles we see are ox carts, bicycles, and the occasional motorbike. There's a tiny well, some handmade canals, and a network of garden hoses providing a weak but rather ingenious irrigation system of sorts for a small portion of a typical 10-acre farm. But there's no water pressure. And except for a little triangle of dirt, this farm is vulnerable to drought and heat, not at all uncommon here in central India. So we've been talking to the head of a family of five who farms this land here in this small village. And he tells us that he farms ginger and watermelon and a little bit of wheat, potatoes, some other crops. At the end of each year, he and his family earn about, if they're lucky, 45,000 rupees. That breaks down to about $1,000 for his family of five over the course of a year. Let's break that down further. What that means is each person in that family has to get by over the course of a year on about $200, which means every day each member of this family lives on roughly 50 cents a day.
There's nothing here. There's not enough electricity, not enough water. One has to work very hard and you don't make enough money. There aren't enough rewards for the work that we do.
In an open-air school, nearly 100 village children from ages 5 to 15 learned the basics. But what then? Well, the majority will head to the cities in search of education, new jobs. But for those unable to find new jobs, well, the future is this. Hauling ginger from the fields in heavy wicker baskets, trying to eke out a subsistence living in conditions only incrementally better than what one would find in some of the least developed countries in Africa. And keep in mind, this is India for almost two-thirds of the population, or roughly 600 million people.
I believe by not concentrating on agriculture, we have created a quagmire of absolute concern at the lowest level. And here lies the dichotomy.
Suhail Seth is a Delhi-based economist and cultural commentator.
For a government which swept to power, talking about the common man and saying that we'll work for the common good, who's actually grown? Who's become wealthier? Where are the riches concentrated? The basic problem is that India is on the move but doesn't know which direction it needs to go to.
Modern India is sending rockets to the moon, yet it hasn't found a way to get tractors onto farms. There's not even the most basic chain to keep food refrigerated once harvested. In fact, 27% of all the food produced on Indian farms simply rots before it gets to market. Suhail Seth calls it shameful. It's something else, too. It's a recipe for long-term instability. In rural districts across India, and especially in the West, Maoist insurgencies called Naxalites have emerged as a serious threat to Western-style development.
Is it a danger? It is a huge danger. Because with that, there is an armed struggle going on between the government of India and these Naxalites. But the struggle is based on real reasoning. You cannot keep an entire pool of humanity within this country out of real progress. So if the politician can't fight for that poor farmer in Guntur, someone else will. It just so happens that that someone else has a gun. He doesn't care for the ballot.
In fact, the Indian government declared the Naxalite movement the most serious threat to India's national security. Of course, that was before the Mumbai attacks. The sun has set back in High Tech City, just 60 miles from the village and yet a million miles away. Young professionals, the people who populate India's rising middle class, wind down their long days with long nights on the town. For Sarisha, our legal outsourcing entrepreneur, this is an exciting golden age, one that, from this vantage point at least, looks like it'll only get better. She decides to call it a day after a mere 12 hours at the office.
Today I managed to finish up one of the training that we have scheduled early, so I decided to take a break, so nothing to complain. It's been a great day.
You can appreciate her enthusiasm. You can feel the pulse of something exciting here. But at the same time, there's no escaping a reality about modern-day India, that it is, in effect, two Indias. An economic miracle, sure, but just for a narrow portion of the Indian people. In High Tech City, it's almost midnight, and almost midday in New York. New York, London, Hong Kong, Tokyo. In every hotel and many modern places of business, 1 clock will not do. Although physically, India is roughly a third the size of the U.S. or everything east of the Mississippi, its ambition is nothing less than global in scale, though its tone can sometimes be misleading. Correspondent Keith Porter has been reading between the lines, or maybe reading is not quite the right word here.
David, listening is probably more like it. You're listening to the official soundtrack of India's foreign policy, relaxing, therapeutic music recorded for the Indian government on CDs that are given to people who visit the Foreign Ministry building in New Delhi. We were handed our copies by Anant Sharma, the country's Minister of State for External Affairs. India's foreign policy, he says, is like the music, smooth and easy.
We believe in creating a better understanding so that we can coexist in harmony. We want this region to be a region of stability, peace, and progress. That's what India's endeavor throughout has been.
I'm Harry Reasoner in New York. These are tonight's headlines. India claims and Pakistan denies that Indian forces have scored major victories in East Pakistan. India recognizes the rebel Bangladesh government in East Pakistan.
But the quest for harmony has not always proved easy for India. In December 1971, the country was fighting one of three wars it waged with Pakistan, this one over the struggle for independence in neighboring Bangladesh.
The United States, Russia, and mainland China were in action again today on the diplomatic front as the UN Security Council met to resume debate on the India-Pakistan war.
It was the height of the Cold War. India was an ally of the Soviet Union, Pakistan a friend of the United States, and as the battle raged, superpower politics were in play.
Well, historically, we have had problems finding a harmonious environment in our neighborhood. Now, it's not a situation of our creation. No country chooses its geographical neighbor. We do not control or influence what happens beyond our territory. We do not have the luxury or comfort of a quiet neighborhood.
The Indian government argues that the country has been a victim of geographical circumstance, that its lack of positive relationships in its own backyard is due to the behavior of its neighbors and should not be seen as a negative reflection on India.
And in that context, whether it's Pakistan, whether it's Bangladesh or Sri Lanka, Nepal, Bhutan, all of them have in some ways or another tried to balance Indian preponderance.
Dr. Harsh Pant of King's College in London has written extensively on Indian foreign and security policy.
India is surrounded by weak states. Many of them are on the verge of failing states. So I think there's a tension there inherent in the structural limitations that India faces in its neighborhood.
And yet, India certainly is not backward in displaying its military prowess. Every January 26th, Republic Day is marked by an enormous display of firepower in New Delhi. The country's nuclear-equipped armed forces march past the president, their commander-in-chief. He also reviews some of the military's advanced hardware. There are tanks and APCs rumbling through the center of New Delhi, as well as missiles and a traditional flypast by the country's air force. The Indian military is growing. It's acquiring new aircraft carriers to modernize its navy and wants at least one nuclear-powered submarine.
I think it's more about being a regional power than a hegemon. India is not really looking at a belligerent, aggressive, proactive foreign policy.
Swapna Nayudu is an associate fellow at the Indian Army's own think tank, the Center for Land Warfare Studies in New Delhi. She says the country must resolve its disagreements with its neighbors if it's to achieve its goal of becoming an effective facilitator of regional diplomacy.
I think this resolution to these conflicts is the first step towards anything positive. And a lot of these conflicts are seen as intractable. And the fact that that perception has been there for so long, that view with the Indian public, is almost as old as India's independence. So there are a lot of problems.
There are old problems, like the disputed territory of Kashmir, over which India and Pakistan have been wrangling since 1947. External Affairs Minister Sharma says progress on building a more productive relationship with Pakistan was completely derailed by last November's terror attacks on Mumbai.
We cannot have these attacks and talks, and we cannot just be smiling at each other, saying that the peace process is on and you come and kill our people and don't act against the perpetrators. That's not on.
And then there are new problems, like the battle for influence in the region between India and a rapidly growing China. Again, Dr. Harsh Pant of King's College in London.
India seems that it is surrounded by these weak and vulnerable states that have started establishing ties with another of its potential adversary, which is China. It's a structural conundrum that India faces, how to get out of this logjam. And India has not yet found a meaningful way of doing that.
Today, I have the honor of signing legislation that builds on the growing ties between the world's two largest democracies, India and the United States.
What India has succeeded in developing is an entirely new relationship with the United States.
This legislation will enhance our cooperation in using nuclear energy to power our economies.
And the signing of the U.S.-India Nuclear Cooperation Act by President George W. Bush at the White House in October of 2008 was perhaps its crowning moment. The U.S. and India argue the deal will help New Delhi develop more nuclear energy for peaceful use. Critics contend that India, which refuses to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, should not be rewarded by pledges of U.S. support for its nuclear program.
Energy security has been very important to India's foreign policy for the past few years. India is an energy deficient country, and that has been a concern for a long time now.
Analysts like Swapna Nayudu of New Delhi's Center for Land Warfare Studies argue that, whatever its merits, the nuclear deal has helped further India's quest for global respect.
Especially in India, there is a perception that we are an important global player, and we feel the need for the rest of the world to recognize that.
From Washington's perspective, it's too early in President Obama's term to know whether ties with New Delhi will turn more on India's relationship with Pakistan and the so-called war on terror, or on India's economic prospects. At her confirmation hearings, Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton seemed to suggest the U.S. could have it both ways.
We will build on our economic and political partnership with India, the world's most populous democracy and a nation with growing influence in the world.
Good morning. 6,018th meeting of Security Council is called to order.
But Washington and the world are going to have to contend with India's unapologetic campaign to play a greater role on the world stage, symbolized by its quest for a permanent seat at the United Nations Security Council. The U.S., the United Kingdom, France, Russia, and China all have permanent Security Council seats, giving them veto powers over any measure that comes before the world body. India's External Affairs Minister, Anant Sharma.
You cannot have a multilateral system to be called representative if it does not include India. You cannot have a world order or multilateral institutions which remains frozen in what emerged after the Second World War, when more than two-thirds member states of the United Nations were not independent nations.
But changing the permanent seats on the Security Council has proven impossible over the last 60 years. So India may have to seek other venues where it can exercise a global voice, and it's already a regular guest at the annual G8 meetings of the world's largest economic powers. Minister Sharma says the country is already assuming the larger global burdens that come with a greater global role.
India has an impeccable record as a responsible member of the global community. We have contributed hugely in the UN peacekeeping operations, and we will continue to do that along with other countries to create a world where there is justice and equity, and there is security and hope.
It's a global ambition that India is pursuing from the heart of one of the world's most unruly neighborhoods. The relaxing, therapeutic music distributed by the country's foreign ministry expresses peaceful harmonies that, for now, are drowned out by the discordant geopolitical dissonance in India's own backyard. For India Rising, I'm Keith Porter.
India's bright dreams cannot obscure a darker backdrop. Can a nation become a major player on the world stage, a political, military, and economic force to be reckoned with, while leaving millions of its own people behind in conditions beyond mere poverty as most of us think of it? Coming up, we go to the slums of Mumbai as our special report, India Rising, continues. From the Stanley Foundation, KQED Public Radio, and KUT Austin, you're listening to India Rising. I'm David Brown. For many Americans, the Oscar-winning film Slumdog Millionaire is their only real connection to India. And yet, at its heart, the film is a shamelessly romantic boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy does everything to get her back again story. Far more Frank Capra than Bollywood, truth be told. But there's one fleeting scene that says a lot about the India of today. Two brothers, in their 20s, sit in the skeleton of a new high-rise being built in downtown Mumbai. Looking down in bemusement on all the construction below, one says to the other, "That used to be our slum down there." Talk about romance. In fact, it may be a measure of how much India's ascent is becoming popular wisdom that one really wants to believe the Dickensian squalor of old Bombay has been replaced by the new growth of urban Mumbai. Correspondent Kristen McHugh discovered something quite different.
David, I'm standing in the very place where parts of Slumdog Millionaire were actually filmed. This is Mumbai's Dharavi neighborhood, and it is Asia's largest slum. As many as 1 million residents live here in an area roughly the size of New York City's Central Park. Many residents live in makeshift brick and concrete buildings perched between narrow alleyways. But far from the bright movie set lights, the story of Dharavi is much more complex than that of extreme poverty. It is a hub of economic activity and at the center of a large controversy, one that could have huge implications for the rest of India's slum dwellers. On a crowded, dusty street sits a spotless white delivery truck bearing the words Medhi Tempo Service. It represents Siddharth Medhi's future.
I worked as a driver, and I also have a business called Sound Service. I've just bought a small truck.
Siddharth Medhi has lived in the Dharavi slum for 40 years. Wearing a crisp white shirt that matches the shine of his new truck, he tells me he sometimes makes as little as 1,000 rupees a month, or roughly $20. Siddharth Medhi believes his truck gives him a fighting chance to make ends meet for his family, but feeding his family isn't his only challenge. Siddharth and his wife live in a tidy 10 by 10 foot room nestled along a small courtyard that doubles as a makeshift laundry and kitchen sink. Every available inch of Siddharth's home is stacked floor to ceiling with the family's personal possessions, leaving very little floor space for actual living. One of Siddharth's two sons lives in a similar dwelling next door. Though the living conditions are not ideal by Western standards, it is a space Siddharth proudly claims as his own, and he doesn't want to give it up without a fight.
They want to demolish our huts and make a green park. That's what they've told us. This spot where I'm standing is going to become a garden.
The green space Siddharth refers to is part of a public-private initiative called the Dharavi Redevelopment Project. Officially backed by the local government, the plan calls for private investors to transform all 535 acres that comprise Dharavi to make way for a new middle-class neighborhood.
We brought this plan to the government.
American-educated urban designer Sean Mehta, along with his father Mukesh, is spearheading the drive to redevelop the Dharavi slum.
55% of Bombay's population lives in slums. Another 25% of the city live in old and dilapidated buildings, which are ready to collapse. So if a city's ever had a chance to reinvent itself, to make its mark in the international world, I believe that the process through which it will happen is through slum rehabilitation.
Under the plan, residents will receive a 269-square-foot apartment located in a new high-rise building. The new neighborhood will include healthcare facilities, public schools, and opportunities for economic development. It will also include green space and recreational areas. The Dharavi Redevelopment Plan presently covers 57,000 families, but residents and opponents question how that figure was calculated. There is no official census on record for Dharavi. Some estimate the population is as high as 1 million. Sean Mehta believes there are only 350,000 residents.
We have only one plea.
Again, resident Siddharth Medhi.
He says he's taken an official survey, but it was done from the air by helicopter. Tell him to come into Dharavi. He should meet with all of us personally. Then he will actually realize what Dharavi is all about.
Sean Mehta says Siddharth Medhi is outright wrong.
We've distributed 70,000 pamphlets in 6 different languages explaining exactly how the project is going to work and what amenities. And I've taken a signature or a thumbprint against each of those pamphlets, incidentally. So if there's any hut that can tell me that they've not gotten information on this project, I'm fairly certain I can prove them wrong.
No matter how you look at it, the plan is complicated. But there is no question as to why Dharavi's land is so valuable. Mumbai's major transit lines run through Dharavi, making it a perfect location for the commuting class the new plan hopes to attract. John Bai's kitchen overlooks some of the valuable rail lines. John Bai is a member of the Slum Dwellers Federation, a coalition looking to negotiate with local governments for better land and services. As one of Dharavi's more fortunate residents, Bai lives in a 2-story, 1,500-square-foot home and stands to lose much of that space under the Dharavi redevelopment plan. He's not opposed to improvements, but he's concerned about the loss of business space.
We want redevelopment, and who doesn't want redevelopment?
Everybody wants good facilities, good amenities, safe water, toilets, all these things. Schools and those kinds of facilities everybody wants, but not at the cost of our bread and butter. See, most of the people, they're earning a living in their house itself. They've got small home industries. Now, if we're displaced from this place, we can't do all these businesses.
Blocks away from John's house is the home of one of Dharavi's most celebrated trades, pottery. Here, among narrow and smoke-filled alleyways, artisans hand throw and spin clay into ceramic ware. They use traditional methods, including earthen kilns that belch out polluting smoke.
They don't understand, actually. The kind of space we need, they don't understand that.
J.S. Stank is the grandson of a ceramic maker and a fifth-year architect student still living in Durarvi. He worries the current redevelopment plan will eliminate manufacturing space and the ceramic artisan tradition.
There will be no drying space, actually, which this spot needs. No manufacturing space, because in this government plant we have only residential place, no commercial place for these potteries.
I'll tell you, the potters are actually a slightly more complicated issue because they have larger homes. So they're not fitting into what the norms are that the government has described earlier as 269.
Again, Sean Maida.
Right now those negotiations are going on, so we're trying to formulate a separate policy for the potters. But until then, they're not going to say the kindest things about the project.
Sean Maida says the redevelopment plan includes vocational training, upgraded trade and manufacturing facilities, and the opportunity for residents to work their way out of poverty. But not everyone is convinced the Durarvi redevelopment project, or any slum redevelopment project for that matter, is about improving lives.
The Durarvi issue is not about relocation. It is not about genuine benevolence. It's about greed. And it is typical of Bombay. It's typical of what we've seen as far as land grabbing is concerned. It's all about the land.
Suhail Seth is a New Delhi-based economist and cultural commentator.
It's not about the people. And when you run a country, when the people don't matter, when the people are irrelevant, when people are marginalized, you will face some form of dissent and you will face some sort of upheaval.
Back in Durarvi, women and men beat garments against concrete blocks in an open sewage pit amid the sight and stench of human waste. Steps away, John Bai sits on the rooftop under a maze of electric transmission lines and doesn't seem to mind. To him, Durarvi is home.
I'll be staying here at least 10 years. We'll be here.
Durarvi's developers disagree.
This project is going to happen. It's a necessity for the city. It's a lot of money for the real estate developers. It's important for the city as a whole to get this area back.
As Siddharth Medhi drives his truck down the familiar streets of his neighborhood, he doesn't have any plans to leave soon.
Our representatives are talking to the government because they know what's best for us. All of us collectively, people of all religions, Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, Christians, and all religions, we're all fighting, united for Durarvi.
For India Rising, I'm Kristen McHugh, Mumbai.
It's worth contemplating that last point just a little further, because it's that observation right there in the slums that may well be the key to getting a grasp on India's future. For when we put the words together, India Rising, there's the risk that we have in mind a mythical India, a single people. But what does one make of hammers and sickles on posters adjacent to sparkling new shopping malls? If this is the India of the future, what then for the crowded alleys which wind their way to the sacred temples? What will this modern India look like? You try to imagine it by walking the streets of India's great cities, riding the buses and trains, visiting its villages, and yet the more you see, the less it seems to make sense. Until you begin to allow for the idea of more than one India, but rather something a lot more like Durarvi. Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, Christians, a society of coalitions, a society that works because of mutual accommodation and for the same reason, seems to be something of a shambles, in a state of constant chaos and disrepair. When we in the West talk glibly about India's promise and potential as the largest democracy in the world, our experience and imagination fail us. India is a much messier business than much of the West perceives. Globalization, that seemingly irresistible force, is changing India in ways that both exacerbate existing tensions and yet galvanize and polarize interests in India in such a way that for the first time, it's possible to conceive of one Indian nation, unified, on the ascent, growing at a pace that grabs global headlines and yet, at precisely the same time, more sharply divided than ever before, and at its center, growing desperate and lean. Dunu Roy is a political economist and a leading Indian thinker.
That tipping point is going to come because if 29% is benefiting,
Then there's a 71% which is not. This is never talked about by economists, and that 71%, I suspect, is going to have much to say in the near future.
It is an ominous vision, to be sure, but it is not universal. Novelist Gucharan Das is a prominent Indian commentator and newspaper columnist.
My mother, she once asked me, she says, you know, you write in your columns about India growing at 8%, China growing at 10%, and you get very upset that this 2% gap is there. And explain to me, what does this 2% gap mean? So I said, well, it's very important, because 2% means that we could save 20 years. That 20 years is a whole generation that could be lifted out of poverty if you grew faster. And she thought about that. And then she said, well, we've waited 3,000 years for this moment. So let's do it right. Let's do it the Indian way. Let's do it with democracy. Let's not do it the way Chinese are doing it.
This is definitely not the way China is doing it. From where I stand, on the lush green campus of the India School of Business, one of the top 15 business schools in the world, a new batch of Indian capitalist leaders is being minted every 4 months or so. And on the horizon, literally as far as the eye can see, there's nothing but desert and new construction. Dozens of new skyscrapers emerging from the clay and rock like a 21st century Vegas rising from the middle of an Indian Mojave. It's all connected by a new superhighway, still under construction, which leads to a gleaming new airport, Rajiv Gandhi International. All over, the billboards carry the same message. Imagine your brand here. When the dust settles on this new city dubbed Cyberabad, local leaders believe it will become a new hub, a new India Gate, a new kind of port for a new world. At the moment, however, Cyberabad is more a wish cast in concrete, a ghost town under construction, waiting for the dawn of the Indian century. On the long flight home, I'm feeling somewhat disappointed. I didn't get to see the Taj Mahal. I saw instead the Taj Hotel. For some reason, it seemed more important, I don't know. Maybe next time. The plane lands back in the States and I hop into the taxi exhausted and reach for my wallet and pull out nothing but leftover rupees. And I can't help but laugh a little on the inside. Not just because I forgot to hit the ATM machine, but as I fan those notes in front of me, I notice for the first time that each one bears the same picture of a smiling Mahatma Gandhi. One of those tiny, inconsequential details that you'd otherwise overlook, but in the quiet of the taxi, enveloped in fatigue, it's almost as if the moment begins to tell its own story. It was Gandhi who told a desperate people fighting for their place among the independent nations of the planet to be patient. In a gentle way, you can shake the world, he promised. With a handful of rupees, it occurs to me that that promise is still playing out. Slowly, gently, at its own pace, but no less inevitably, shaking the world. And maybe that is the real story of India, rising. India Rising was produced by Simon Marks, Kristen McHugh, and Keith Porter for the Stanley Foundation, KQED Public Radio, and KUT Austin. On the web at kqed.org, kut.org, and stanleyfoundation.org. Our associate producer is Christina McGillibray. Our sound engineer was Rima Snyder of Red Wagon Audio. Special thanks to Ken Mills, Sapna Bhatia, Mahima Kaul, Carl Bergman, and the staff of Feature Story News. For more information about India Rising or to share your thoughts about this program, visit us online at stanleyfoundation.org. I'm David Brown. Thanks for joining us.